May it please the court, we are here today to talk about what a lender must do in order to rescind a notice of acceleration. For over 110 years, the law in Texas had been quite clear. The only way that a lender could revoke or rescind a notice of acceleration was, number one, accept late payments from the debtor, or number two, issue a written rescission of the acceleration and either record it in the deed records or at least send it to the debtor. In this particular case, the trial court held and found that a notice of arrearages that was sent in December, approximately 3 years after the notice of acceleration, counted as a rescission of the acceleration and granted summary judgment in favor of the bank. And we've appealed the case because
and we are talking about abandonment.
About what, Judge?
Abandonment. That's
rescission of the acceleration or abandonment, either one.
I mean, in other words, is abandonment a word of art? Is rescission a word of art, or what? Or is it interchangeable?
I think that they're interchangeable, and in this particular case. The law had been, as I discussed, since, and it was reaffirmed by the Texas Supreme Court in 2001 in the Holy Cross case. And in this particular case, the holding that the letter of the current arrearages counted as a abandonment of the notice of acceleration or the rescission of the notice of acceleration operates to permit the U.S. Bank to determine whatever statute of limitations it wants to have. In other words, it can...
Tell me why this is not correct, that you do judge abandonment basically on the same principles as you would judge waiver. It has to be the known relinquishment of an intended right.
Correct.
If a bank just said, not even tied to these facts but somewhat, gives a notice of acceleration, and the borrower, the debtor, calls up and says, look, we can work this thing out. So he sends to the debtor the thing that they've worked out, and he says, okay, this is what you owe for arrearage. You pay this, please send us a check. Well, you know at that point, he has abandoned his right to he's abandoned his right to foreclose at that time.
I agree. But it was a joint decision by both of them.
Okay. The abandonment of the right is not, because that's what he gives up. In other words, it resulted from a joint decision, I guess.
Correct.
But abandonment would be, he has the right to abandon it unilaterally.
He does. I agree.
But and why wouldn't that be? And so then the debtor,
okay,
reneges on his deal.
Easy. You can abandon it, but it's got to be clear and unequivocal. And in that connection, the Texas legislature just passed a bipartisan bill, which is rare for the Texas legislature, and it states and amends the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code and says that the lender can abandon the notice of acceleration by sending written notice to the debtor stating that it's abandoning the notice of acceleration. And in this particular case, had the lender, U.S. Bank, said in the letter stating the amount of arrearages that it was abandoning the notice of acceleration, then we wouldn't be here today. But just a statement by the lender sending out what the current arrearages are
You mentioned the new law, but that we don't get to apply that one in this case, do we?
No, Your Honor, we don't. But I think that it's instructive about what the Texas Supreme Court would do in requiring that there be clear, unequivocal notice to a debtor that the acceleration is being abandoned or rescinded. And
why isn't that just an indication that the legislature is unhappy with what the courts are doing? I mean, you can't make any judgment.
Well, that could be too. That could be too. Texas legislature, Your Honor, who knows? But our position is very simple in this regard, and that is we think that the notice of abandonment or the notice of rescission has to be clear and unequivocal. A statement about past arrearages is neither. So that being the case, we believe that when there is a controversy over what the meaning of the communication is, and that creates a question of fact for the jury to decide. So in this particular case, we've done no discovery about who made the decision to send the letter to the Bournes. We've had no discovery about what the purpose the bank had in sending the letter to the Bournes was, and we submit to the court that that the court should remand the case so that we can do some discovery to find out what the bank meant when it sent this letter, and let us try that portion of the case to a jury.
Don't you judge it by an objective? It's an objective decision as to whether it was or was not the intention of the bank to make that decision.
That's the judge made an objective decision, but looking at the letter, there's different conclusions that can be derived from reading the same letter. The letter does not mention abandoning the notice of acceleration. The letter didn't say anything about that. So that's something that got read into the letter, and we don't know what the bank meant. There's no need for us to.
I'm not trying to interrupt your argument, but yes, I am. But the conduct of the bank, it seems to me, was that it was clearly giving up its right to foreclose at that time. You call it temporarily giving up its right, but it waived its right to foreclose when it writes to the debtor and says, if you bring your arrearages up to this point, we will not foreclose.
But okay, maybe that's true, but that doesn't say that it's abandoning its notice of acceleration.
Now here, and then they continue to go through the same jump the same hoops on 736.
Right.
Time and again, indicating that they have abandoned their earlier efforts at trying to foreclose and are renewing their efforts. I mean, all that conduct would seem like that it from an objective point of view.
Well, let's look at it another way, and that is the way the statute is worded. Once the bank has filed an expedited notice of foreclosure, which is what those are, then the easy way to defeat that notice is simply to file another lawsuit that challenges the bank's ability to foreclose. And then under that statute, the court has to dismiss the case. So I don't think that that's an intentional abandonment by anything by U.S. Bank. That's a requirement of the statute, that once any lawsuit got filed challenging their ability, the court had to dismiss it. There's no discretion according to the statute. And if U.S. Bank had wanted to, all they had to do was file a lawsuit for a judicial foreclosure. And instead of filing the 736 actions, they could have filed a lawsuit for judicial foreclosure at any time. And they just did not do it. And in this particular case, I submit to the court that I could represent the most badly injured person on the planet, but if I didn't file suit within the proper statute of limitations, the court would say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And I submit that this is a similar situation here. The bank knew about its four-year statute of limitations. The four-year statute of limitations was triggered when it sent the notice of acceleration. It never did anything to tell the Bournes that it was abandoning its notice of acceleration. It never said that it was doing anything to rescind its notice of acceleration. Instead, it sent out one ambiguous document that said, here's your current arrearages. Well, that could have been just spit out by the computer to all the debtors who were 1 month late or 2 months late or whatever it might have been. But we submit to the court that that statement was neither clear nor ambiguous, nor can it be the basis of a holding as a matter of law that the bank abandoned its notice of acceleration. But rather, we contend that that statement, because of its ambiguity, simply creates a question of fact. And we should have discovery in this case to determine what the bank meant when it was sending that letter. And for those reasons, we would simply ask that the court remand.
What do you mean we have to see what the court meant? What the bank meant, because whoever sent those letters don't know what the heck they were talking about. They just did it routinely. But what kind of conduct, what from the bank's conduct, what kind of objective conclusion, what kind of conclusion do you come to objectively based on this particular conduct?
None. That particular letter, no conclusion whatsoever, except that's the amount of arrearage
that's what you
at that time.
That's,
Right.
If you test, you wouldn't need to take depositions to find out what the bank's intent was, because nobody knows what its objective intent was.
And that's exactly right. And so the district judge in this case here, he couldn't have known what the bank's intent was in sending that letter. And by trying to divine...
Well, I'd say, I assume that we were not going to foreclose.
Pardon?
I would say, I assume that we were not going to foreclose if we sent out a letter telling him to get his mortgage payments up to date.
Okay, but that still didn't state that they're abandoning their notice of acceleration. That's a magic time. The bank can always, the bank is the only one I know of that can control its limitations. All it has to do is send a notice of acceleration and send another notice saying that it's going to abandon that, and then it'll extend its statute of limitations.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I'm clear on what relief you're seeking. We're here on a motion for summary judgment. Is that right?
Yes, summary judgment.
All right, and so your argument then is that there is some genuine dispute regarding an issue of material fact.
Yes, correct, Judge.
And that is whether or not the bank abandoned the acceleration.
That's exactly right.
And the right to foreclose.
That's correct.
And you're saying that's not a question of law, but that's a factual determination to be made by whom?
By a jury.
Yes. So you get to a jury on the question of whether or not the bank abandoned.
Yes, correct.
All right. And what's the jury going to be able to look at or hear that the judge doesn't have already?
Well, we're going to have some testimony from the person who sent the notice, or perhaps the person with the bank who was in charge of this account, about why that notice got sent and what the purpose of sending the notice was.
Okay, so that notice, you contend, is ambiguous.
Right, there's been no discovery.
But you concede it is unambiguous that they did, at least on two or three different occasions, assert that they wanted to foreclose.
That they sent notices of a lesser amount?
No, what's the 736?
Pardon me?
What's the 736?
736, Your Honor, is an expedited foreclosure. And that's where the bank files suit, and it's styled differently than a normal lawsuit.
So that's pretty clear that they want to foreclose.
Yes, absolutely.
And they file that.
Yes, they file
that's
at least.
Not ambiguous. So what's ambiguous is whether or not they abandoned, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
All right, and in making that determination, if we reverse and say the summary judgment was inappropriately granted, then the fact question is, would go to the ambiguity of those subsequent letters where yes. They talked about arrearages.
Yes, correct, Your Honor. That's right. That's right.
You filed the declaratory judgment.
Right.
Seeking to ask the question of whether the statute of limitations had expired.
Correct.
And so the burden is on you in this case to prove your case.
Actually, what I filed was a declaratory action to have the court, trial court, declare that the bank had lost the action to foreclose by virtue of running into statute of limitations. Having raised that affirmatively, it was up to the U.S. Bank to prove that the statute of limitations had not run. So then the burden changed to them to prove that the statute had not run.
That is a tricky question.
Pardon?
It's a tricky question because you have an affirmative defense that puts it on the bank to plead it as a defense. But on the other hand, this is a declaratory action where you are seeking the declaratory judgment of the court to say
true.
That the statute of limitations bars this case.
That's true.
So I don't know who has the burden and who doesn't.
Well, because then after they removed the case to federal court, they filed a counterclaim seeking judicial foreclosure. So at that point in time, they for sure had the burden of proof on proving that the statute of limitations had not run that precluded them from foreclosing. So I think it's quite clear that that's U.S. Bank's burden of proof. And I think that that's why in this particular case, that letter that U.S. Bank sent out presents a fact question for a jury to determine.
Yeah, but you can't see, I don't see how you really can say that it's a fact question. I mean, you could say that you win on the basis of the law. I understand that.
But
now you can say there's a fact question involved in here for a jury to determine. I don't see it myself, because you can't tell me that a bank that sends these out routinely can recall exactly what they had in mind, some officer, exactly what he had in mind, when he probably didn't have anything in mind.
Well, if he didn't have anything in mind, if he didn't have anything in mind, then he didn't intend to abandon the notice of acceleration.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
I mean, because it's a matter of the law and what the practices of the bank are and all of that.
I don't know. That's why we need some discovery to find out. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wright. You've reserved some rebuttal time. Mr. McClain.
Yes, Your Honor. So may it please the court. My name is Brad McClain. I'm here on behalf of U.S. Bank, the appellee, and the defendant in the district court below. Just to pick up with the issue of who has the burden of proof in a statute of limitations issue, Texas law is clear that the party raising statute of limitations as a defense has the burden of proof to show that the cause of action has accrued. So that burden rests on the Bourns here to show that the cause of action has accrued, and then 4 years from that date, then the statute of limitations has run.
I thought it was an affirmative defense that the bank would have to prove.
It wasn't an affirmative defense. The petition was a declaratory judgment requesting that the statute of limitations barred our foreclosure action. We move for summary judgment against their affirmative defense. So they would have the burden to show that the cause of action has accrued and the statute of limitations has run. Now, it's our position that this case has no fact disputes at all, so it's a perfect case for summary judgment. The facts are this. The Bourdons have been in their home since 2009 without making a payment on a $640,000 home equity loan. In regards to U.S. Bank, U.S. Bank sent three separate notices of default to the Bourdons over a four-year period, informing them that they were delinquent on their loan and that they didn't cure their default, that U.S. Bank would then accelerate the full maturity of that debt. Now, despite the Bourns' refusal to cure their debt, they're here today before this court asking you to permanently bar U.S. Bank from exercising the only remedy it has in Texas for enforcing its debt in a Texas home equity loan action. Now, the Texas legislature has recently confirmed that a lender can abandon acceleration, simply by sending a notice of rescission. Unlike what the Bourns have advocated, that notice does not have to be recorded in the real property records. It can just be sent directly to the borrowers. Also, the provision states...
We don't have that here, do we, counsel?
It's not before the court in the sense that it wasn't before the district court, but...
But what's not before us is anything from the bank where the bank says, I'm rescinding.
The three default notices, they say, if you do not cure this amount of default, each default notice specifies a different amount to cure the default. It says, we will accelerate your loan. So by the very language of the default notice, it says, even though it doesn't use the abandonment language, it is putting them on notice that, hey, you have now the right to cure this default within the original maturity date, which is a 30-year note, and if you don't do that within 45 days, I think is typically what it says, then we will proceed to accelerate the loan and move forward with foreclosure. And those are three separate notices, and those dates were, the first default notice was sent on, on March 19th, 2009, and that's on page 177 to 178 of the record, followed up by a notice of acceleration in May of 2009, which is what they argue accrues the statute of limitations when the cause of action for foreclosure accrued. The second default notice was sent in May of 2010, so a little over a year later. The first default notice requested $11,000. The second default notice requested $74,000. And then the third and final default notice was sent in November of 2012, requesting over $218,000 to cure the default. Because what happened here, each time U.S. Bank would then move to...
And did each one say, and if you don't, we will accelerate?
The first one said that, the second one said that, the third one said, you may already be in foreclosure proceedings, so we'll continue down that road if that's the case. But arguably, the second notice, at the very least, put them on notice that U.S. Bank was moving off its first acceleration, was re-accelerating the loan, and then would move forward with acceleration and foreclosure if they didn't cure that $74,000 default. And that's what the trial court found. You know, Judge Jolly, as you recognize, by U.S. Bank's objective actions and through the documents it sent, it was putting the Bourns on notice that they were moving off that first acceleration, that May 2009 acceleration. And that's what all the case law in Texas has said consistently. Whether it be, you know, there's not a lot of state court cases right now because all these cases get remanded to federal court. But the federal district courts almost unanimously have said, if the lender takes any actions to move off its acceleration, that is sufficient, absent some type of fact issue that the borrower brings forward. And the fact issues that the courts have recognized, and this isn't uniform across the courts, but what they've tended to say there has to be some issue of showing that you objected to the abandonment. So it has to be some type of objective evidence that you objected to the abandonment or that you detrimentally relied on the prior acceleration. And the evidence the courts have offered up there is that you have to show maybe that you secured a refinance of your mortgage to pay off the loan or you secured a contract to sell your property to pay off the loan. So therefore, you can show a negative impact on you for relying on that acceleration. The boards here haven't showed either of those instances. They can't.
So is it the 2012 notice that's the focal point?
They're arguing that it's the 2009 acceleration that caused it. We're arguing that U.S. Bank first abandoned acceleration in, which would be the second default notice, which is in May of 2010. So therefore, they abandoned acceleration within that four-year period after that first acceleration. And so therefore, even now, you tack on 4 years from the subsequent September acceleration, our counterclaim for judicial foreclosure is within that time period, so the statute of limitations does not apply.
Well, it just seems to me as a practical matter that if the bank sends you a notice that this is how much you owe, and if you pay this, you will be even with the bank, that they're not going to foreclose. I mean, they have abandoned. If you do this, we've abandoned.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's why it's instructive to look at the new Texas law, because even though it wasn't before the trial court in this case, by the express letter of that law, it says it applies retroactively. So if we were to go back down, that's the law that would be applied. And what the legislature said there is, like, this is not the only way you can abandon acceleration. It says explicitly, this is not the exclusive method. There's other ways you can do it. So long as, in the way that, if you look at the bill history, it says the issue is that borrowers and lenders are having this issue where they're negotiating to try to keep the borrowers in the home.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
I mean, we all know it's Hornbook. I mean, on summary judgment, you know, no genuine issue of material fact, but it's also axiomatic that the mover is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So even assuming that there's no factual dispute, it's less than pellucid that there's an entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. And it seems to me every time you allude to what the Texas legislature just did, makes it even less clear to me that there's an entitlement as a matter of law. Now, you might have been in an abstract sense, but just when you just said, okay, that law makes it retroactive, et cetera, so I'm saying, okay, our panel is going to opine something in a vacuum about a state of the record where we got it, when in fact, not just by virtue of judicial notice, but actual notice, that the Texas legislature has done what we often want is some act by either it or the Texas court to tell us what they want done. So if that's the case, it just seems curious, you know, to determine that there's a clear entitlement as a matter of law in a circumstance such as here, where the law has changed, but yet the law change is made expressly retroactive. So my question here is, notwithstanding whether you might be, quote, theoretically correct, why isn't it more prudent, rather than a muddled opinion that has a footnote saying we understand that Texas has done this, but why isn't it a more prudent disposition for you to be back down in front of the trial court with the state of the record you have, but with a new act which is applied retroactively?
Your Honor, on that point, I would say that the judgment in this case in the lower court was consistent with all the other federal cases that have come out of Texas on this issue. There hasn't been an opinion that stood that actually would go against what the district court did in this case. I know this is an issue of first impression of the Fifth Circuit. The Texas courts haven't dealt with this specific issue either. I think that's why the legislature stepped in, just to deal with the state law side of things, to kind of, I guess, maybe clear up some, I don't want to say ambiguity, but the state courts just haven't dealt with it. But the federal courts have. Specifically, one of the ways that federal courts have said and recognized, going off the Texas Supreme Court opinion in the Stewart case, the 1901 Stewart case, saying that abandonment can be inferred from the acts, conducts, and declarations of the parties, the way federal courts have interpreted that then is, well, when a lender sends some type of notice demanding less than the full amount of the accelerated debt, it puts the borrowers on notice that they're abandoning acceleration. And there's at least five cases that have come out of the district courts in Texas that have recognized that. one of them being the Leonard versus Aukman loan servicing case, which a panel of this court affirmed. In that case, the lender sent account statements and then sent a new notice of default, like we did in this case. And the court, the district court there, then the panel of a court here said, yes, that's sufficient to abandon acceleration so long as there's not some evidence of a fact issue of the borrower objecting to the abandonment or detrimental reliance on the prior acceleration. And then the panel in the Leonard case said, basically, there's no fact issue here. The borrowers have brought forth no evidence showing they objected or they detrimentally relied on the prior acceleration. That's the exact same case here. Now, the Bourns have argued that they detrimentally relied on the acceleration by filing a lawsuit. But district courts have recognized, specifically the Callan Court and the Rosas Court, they've recognized that simply filing a suit is not detrimental reliance, and here's why. As I said earlier, the Bourns have been in the house since 2009 without making a payment. Moreover, that by filing the lawsuit, it's actually extended their beneficial use and enjoyment of the property. Under their contract, under their loan agreement, they didn't have the right to be in the house that long for not paying for 6 years. They should have been out. They should have been foreclosed on by that time. But they extended their beneficial use of the property. By very nature of filing a lawsuit, then they didn't detrimentally rely. Their position wasn't worsened. In fact, it was improved. And so the courts have found that just simply filing that type of lawsuit challenging the 736 action is not enough to show detrimental reliance.
So they're still in the house now?
Yes, sir. Because
the last payment made by them was in 2009?
That's correct. So that's why their rearage just grew like from 11,000 to 74,000 to 218,000. And now I think if you roll it all together, I think the original principal of the note was around 640. I think now the total indebtedness is like over $900,000.
So what's the upshot, if any, of counsel opposite's argument about you're filing for a judicial foreclosure? I mean, some of these terms are not clear to me.
Can I back up and explain this kind of the process for like the 736 action so the court's aware of it? As you know, a home equity loan in Texas, it's a non-recourse debt, so you can only recover against the property. The only way you can then foreclose is to get a court order. So the Texas Supreme Court created a procedure under Rule 736, the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, that you can get an expedited order from the court. You have to file an application with the court stating what the amount of the delinquency is and why you're entitled to foreclosure. The only decision issued decided in that proceeding is just whether or not you've established your right to foreclose. It's not an official judicial proceeding. It has no res judicata effects at all as far as subsequent lawsuits. But what you have to show in that, you have to prove that you gave the borrower the requisite notices that you were required to give it. So each of these 736 actions that U.S. Bank filed, they filed four. They filed the first one in June 2009, and in that 736 action, they relied on the first notice of default and the first notice of acceleration. The second 736 action was filed in December of 2009, once again relying on the first notice of default and the first notice of acceleration. The third 736 action was filed in September of 2010, but that one relied on the second notice of default and the second notice of acceleration. And then the final 736 action, the fourth one, was filed in May of 2013, relying on the third notice of default and the third notice of acceleration. So each time, other than that second time, U.S. Bank clearly communicated, hey, this is the default we're relying on. This is the notice of acceleration we're relying on. They abandoned that May 2009 acceleration in the third 736 action and in the fourth 736 action.
They clearly have abandoned it.
I mean, they filed it off record saying, hey.
I mean, and without using the word abandonment, it's a term of art. They have abandoned that first, any kind of reliance on that first.
And that's our position, Your Honor. The courts have said, too, you don't need a written agreement to abandon it. And people just use it to be able to describe what's happened. You don't have to use the word abandon or the word rescission, so long as your conduct.
On the other hand, we know, just again, as a practical matter, that they have never abandoned their right to foreclose. They're not going to give up their right to foreclose. But let me ask, what would be the consequence if we rule against you and in favor of the plaintiff? Do they get the house? I mean, can you ever foreclose?
Well, I would argue simply here, if you rule against us, you're just reversing the summary judgment. Now, if you render for them, they would have the house free and clear of our lien, and we would have no ability to go back to even recover on the debt because we can't bring a delinquency action at all.
you would be foreclosed from taking any action on collecting the amount due on that mortgage.
That's correct. It's a harsh penalty. That's why you.
But right now, counsel, what I heard them asking, I thought, was that they're asking for a determination that summary judgment was inappropriately granted, so that there's still a question of fact on whether or not that's the statute of limitations has run. And that determination could be made against these plaintiffs on a factual basis if the case were just reversed and not rendered, just reversed and remanded.
That's correct. We'd go back and we'd have to kind of litigate this out. But I think that
it goes to the question I asked you, which you never answered.
Which I was going to get. Doesn't a follow? I was going to come back around to that.
But, in case you thought I was paying attention, you know, the question that you gave me an answer, but it wasn't answered.
Well, I think it's important to know how the 736 action works because that's a contractual right.
And this
is why judicial foreclosure doesn't get.
It's just where we are, and that's the question. And the question Judge Jolly just asked you is very illuminating in terms of, you know, that whole business. It's just odd to me somebody could still be in a house 7 years after or whatever, but that's neither here nor there. But the question I was asking you was more of a practical one. I mean, I see we could write on a whole bunch of stuff, but it sort of just doesn't make sense to me writing in the abstract when in fact, you know, the legislature is taking an affirmative action, you know, to clarify, deal with this whole marketplace. So for us, just because this is teed up to do it, somehow it just kind of doesn't work. Not so. That's why I said, well, even if theoretically you're correct in terms of all this that's happened, why isn't the posturing of this case before speak more to even assuming arguendo, no disputed fact, or maybe not without getting to that, but it's not clear that you're entitled as a matter of law to summary judgment, and it just goes back. Well, then that would not.
What are the facts? What fact, if we remanded this, what fact is there to be tried?
Well, that's the flip side. There are no more facts to be decided. I mean, they are what they are. I think that the letters speak for themselves. The Bourne's actions speak for themselves. There's no, I know he's mentioned taking the deposition of somebody who sent the letter. If you look at the notice of default, I mean, he is correct. It's a generated letter. It says, I think, like loan servicing department. I don't know how you'd find the individual that actually sent out that letter.
Well, let me try one more time. And the point I'm getting is, okay, assuming correct, that there's no fact to go back, because I was first about to say, well, we say there's no fact, but we don't say any of that, just say summary judgment is appropriate. Okay, assuming you go back and there are no facts, what I'm trying to hone in is whether or not you, mean your clients, entitled summary judgment as a matter of law, particularly because of the passage of the statute, which is made retroactive. And I don't think until you said that to me that it was resonating to me that law would work. So I'm trying to get to the point, what is the upshot? If we send it back, I'm not saying we are, but if we send it back with saying no more than on this record, summary judgment is inappropriately entered, boom, remand, no commentary on anything. All right, you go back down below, still asserting that there are no factual disputes, traversing there, wanting to take deposition. But isn't the district court then positioned to apply or you to argue what the Texas legislature did in figuring out this whole statute of limitations, or are you still boxed in?
We're still in the same place because the legislature, the law, this talks about actually sending in what I would call an explicit notice of abandonment, basically saying we hereby abandon our prior acceleration. This gives the prima facie, this is the sure way you can do it. But it also says, this law doesn't rule out any other ways of abandoning acceleration. So that's where we are.
Okay.
So I don't think legislature.
It doesn't really cut in your favor. Okay, all right, that's the part I wasn't clear about.
And back to your earlier question about judicial foreclosure, why didn't we bring a claim? I mean, Texas law is clear, and this court has also recognized, and this argument wasn't briefed a lot in the briefs, so it wasn't really raised at the time by appellate, that we're not required to bring a judicial foreclosure claim because we have the contractual right to sell the property. And so, therefore, they can't compel us. It's not a compulsory counterclaim in Texas. And so we're not required to bring it earlier than what we, I guess, and what we have to. I think at this point the bank was just.
I'm a little confused about what is the present state of the Texas law with respect to acceleration.
Yes, sir.
And abandonment. And how that affects this case. Now, tell me about that.
I don't think if this case were to go back down, I don't think it affects this case, and here's why. I'll have the text of the law right in front of me. I know it hasn't been briefed because it was just passed last month.
Does it say that it is to be applied retroactively?
It does say that.
Do we know what that means?
We don't know what that means. Basically, you know, I think the position is of the industry and people have looked at it is that it can be applied backwards to cases that were filed before the law was passed. The problem is that the law itself is just dealing with an explicit notice of rescission, and we don't have that in this case. We don't have a notice that says we are hereby abandoning our prior acceleration. What we have is...
The law applies only when one expressly uses the term rescission to the debtor.
That's what it seems to say, and I would call it's a safe harbor provision. That's what it is.
What?
But counsel...
A safe harbor provision for banks?
But to tell me that is the only purpose to be served by that statute is to tell me that the legislature spend a lot of time designing law to deal with the obvious. If it is obviously a letter of rescission, what would the litigation be about?
Well,
what they said is apparently, if you want to rescind it, you should say it. That's how they're saying to the lenders. This is the kind of language you should use when you want to rescind. But what I hear you telling me now is that all this law did was say if you want to rescind, you should say rescind, and then they're going to make it apply retroactively. Well, if it's retroactive and there are cases where the letter clearly said that, are people actually litigating the cases where there are letters where they actually said we're rescinding?
Yes.
They're litigating those?
Yes. They've lost them, obviously, but they've...
All right.
So that's,
they've lost them.
Yes, they've lost, but they still continue to litigate them. That's the issue. And all this is caused by the mortgage meltdown of 2008, 2009. That's why you're seeing all these cases kind of get smushed together all of a sudden.
So you're saying that this new statute only says rescission means rescission?
The language is pretty clear. It says rescission or waiver of acceleration is effective if made by written notice of rescission or waiver served as provided on the borrower. That's all it says.
It says waiver of acceleration. It just...
Yeah, waiver of that particular, you know, acceleration. It's not a waiver in perpetuity.
And then one other thing, I know you're out of time, but your case at least looks kind of like Fitzgerald v. Harry, and I'm sure you're familiar with that because you were talking about all of the state court cases where the homeowners kept filing for bankruptcy, and then each time the lender would go back and pursue foreclosure once the bankruptcy petition was dismissed. And then what we have here is a 736, and then the suit gets filed, and then it gets dismissed, and then you file another 736. Doesn't this look a lot like that? And in that one, the determination was, well, there was never any abandonment because there was just the relentless pursuit of foreclosure. Mm-hmm. Doesn't yours look like the relentless pursuit of foreclosure when you keep filing these 736s?
It, you know, not knowing the specific facts of whether or not each time, and I'd have to look back in the case. I don't recall off the top of my head if it was a non-judicial foreclosure case versus a one we had to go kind of the judicial route, even if it's a quasi-judicial route. I don't know what acceleration notices they're relying on. I would say that at least in our case, when we moved for the 736 actions, we relied on the new notice of acceleration. So I would argue is probably the difference there. If y'all have no further questions, I would just ask the court to affirm the district court's ruling because there are no fact issues that we abandoned acceleration through our actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClain. Appreciate your responses to our numerous questions. All right, Mr. Wright. Is counsel correct that your clients are still in the house and now that the meter is running at $940,000?
Somewhere in that vicinity.
Chairman Cricket.
And you're going to get it free if you win. Or your client.
Be correct, too. But
where's the
Holy Cross got a church for free as well?
Huh? What?
Holy Cross got a church for free as well.
Well, I know, but I know absurdity when I hear it. And that's absurd. Somebody gets a $9 million house for nothing. I'm not faulting you. You've done a fine job representing them.
Well, the court obviously understands.
The law that we live with.
Yeah. Well, where are you? Let's assume that we're not persuaded by you in brief or argument that there are any fact disputes or, you know, anything that conceivably can be unearthed in depositions, discovery, because people don't know why they sent. As Judge Jolly said, I mean, you know, the machine sent all these things out. So assume we're unpersuaded that there are, quote, fact disputes here to be learned. I mean, where are you?
Then where we are is this court will have held that sending a notice of arrearages counts as a an abandonment of the acceleration, and this court will then give lenders the ability to change up their statute of limitations as they see fit.
Well, why would we be doing all that? All we'd be saying is that, you know, there aren't, in our mind, there aren't any factual disputes on any genuine issues of material fact, and the trial court did not err in rendering summary judgment on behalf of the bank, period, end of sentence. That's all we said. The Texas statute picks up to say whatever it's going to say about the industry. So, I mean, why is it necessarily we're saying all that?
Well, then also this court is holding as a matter of law that the summary judgment was correct, and that means that this ambiguous statement with regard to the arrearages counts as an abandonment of the notice of acceleration.
Yeah, but, I mean, the other side of it is that if we rule in your favor, it curtails any kind of effort on the part of the banks to try to work with the debtor, because he's always going to say the debtor keeps putting him off and putting him off and putting him off. The bank is going to say, look, we're not going to work with you a bit. We are right now, the statute of limitations is running, and we're not going to let it run another inch.
Your Honor,
there's the consequences to the decision, I mean, from both points of view, that's all.
I don't think that it would stop banks from working with the borrowers. I think it would make them pay more attention to their files. I think that they would start judicial foreclosure actions more quickly, and I don't think that they would let things rock around for years like they did here. But I think the bottom line is that once the lender gives, the lender has to give clear and unequivocal notice of abandonment of the notice of acceleration.
To a practical person, if I'm a debtor and I receive a notice from the bank, you pay these arrearages or we're going to foreclose. That means if I pay these arrearages, I'm not going to foreclose. That means by sending out your opportunity to bring it up to date, that you're abandoning your right to foreclose. I'm not going to foreclose on you if you'll pay this money. Abandoning my right to foreclose under these conditions.
Yeah, because the lender, before he sent that letter, sent the notice of acceleration. So if then the lender wanted to extend his statute of limitations in that same letter with the arrearages, he should have said, by the way, we hereby rescind our previous acceleration. That's all they had to do.
There was no doubt in the debtor's mind, objectively speaking, if he paid the arrearages, the foreclosure would not occur.
No, because they kept filing the.
You don't pay arrearages and then have it for.
They kept filing the.
That seems to me, notice to an ordinary businessman or ordinary citizen, that you're not going to foreclose. You pay these arrearages, I'm not going to foreclose. And that is abandoning foreclosure.
I disagree. Respectfully.
I know. Well, I'm more or less talking out loud. So, I mean, I.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks for the opportunity to present the case.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, thank you very both much. Sides.
You both have presented good arguments, and we appreciate it very much.
It's an interesting case, one of which we're happy that the legislature finds itself to clear up so we don't get an abundance of it. It'll be submitted. We'll decide it. That completes our oral argument case. We'll be in recess until 9 a.m. in the morning.